It's been an icy week here in the capital region as we enter mid-February. The fresh air of spring seems both around the corner and an eternity away. Coming up on this episode of The Eagle, we'll go over the week's top headlines.
The state announced that it would be dropping its mask mandate for businesses, but not for schools.
We'll talk to a competitive figure skater for their thoughts on the doping scandal that emerged this week at the Beijing Olympics. And spoiler alert, that figure skater is me.
There's no magic pill that you can take to land your jumps.
That's astounding.
We will meet the man who uses tap to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen in the stage drama Fly, now playing at Albany's Capitol Repertory Theater.
Tap dancing, for me, is a voice.
And did you watch the season finale of the Sex and the City sequel series and Just Like That? If you did, you may have spotted something unique with a tie to the Capital Region.
Brenda was just having a regular day going about her business when she got a random call, and it was an HBO Max producer.
This is The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. A look inside our newsroom. I'm Jessica Marshall.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.
Welcome to The Eagle. I'm Jessica Marshall. First up, let's discuss what appeared in the Times Union and on timesunion.com this week.
All right, we are here once again with Times Union Editor-in-Chief Casey Seiler. Let's talk about the top headlines this week. We'll start with an update on the mask mandate from Governor Kathy Hochul. What's the latest there?
Well, on Wednesday, and it was kind of previewed for a couple of days ahead of that, the state announced that it would be dropping its mask mandate for businesses, but not for schools. The state has come to the conclusion that hospitalization rates have dropped low enough that the business mandate can go. Of course, there are many quarters clamoring for students to be unmasked, for the school mandate to end. And in fact, up in Ballston Spa on Thursday morning, when we're talking, there was a walkout of about 50 or 60 senior students in protest of the mandate remaining in place. And, you know, Colony Center, for example, has opted, announced on Wednesday that it was going to move to make masks optional for businesses. Of course, optional pretty much means that it's kind of do what thou wilt. It's very hard within the setting of a mall for some stores to demand, hey, you got to wear a mask, and other stores not to, although, of course, that is their right. I'm just saying in practice, it's very difficult. So the school mask mandate will remain in place at least for a couple more days or potentially weeks. There are, of course, lawsuits surrounding the school mandate as well as other pandemic mandates that are currently working their way through the court system, including a ruling on Long Island that would have struck down both mandates, conceivably, that remains on hold as the Hochul administration appeals it.
Well, we are going to be watching that very closely. It is a complicated issue, as you said. Moving on to some weather news, we had a bit of an ice storm last weekend that had some repercussions throughout the week. Can you talk about some of what we reported there?
Pete DiMolo wrote about what appears to be a very serious problem in people who did not clean the ice off the tops of their cars, that as things begin to thaw up, as they have over the course of this week, can turn those really hard cookies, plates, platters of ice into spinning, rather dangerous frisbees of peril, if you will, on especially on the highway. I think everybody has probably seen on social media video of that people have taken of ice from the car, a car in front of them flying up into the air and then really almost like a boomerang coming down and hitting their car. Windshield replacement businesses in the capital region have said that they have rarely seen business this busy. I myself drove up into the Adirondacks last Friday night, really just as the storm was dying down. And I'm an experienced snow driver, Jess. You know, I used to live in Wyoming for years, and it was one of the scariest drives I've ever made. Part of the reason was because my car was completely encased in ice, which of course can be, you know, can screw up your windshield wipers. So everything is thawing out as we speak. The temperature's in the 40s. It's just a reminder that take the ice off your sidewalk and take the ice off your car if you can. It is 5 or 10 minutes out of your life that can make a real difference in the lives of the people who are driving behind you.
Absolutely. I have definitely been on the back end of a sheet of flying ice, and it's dangerous and terrifying. But I do have to say, I hope the term Frisbees of Peril, as you've coined it, kind of catches on. I think we should make it a hashtag.
It's the title of my novel, Jess.
All right. Moving on to another reporting series that we've debuted here. We are looking into some issues in the sport of thoroughbred horse racing. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, the series is called Horse Racing Unbridled. The first story by Emily Munson appeared in last Sunday's edition. It looked at the problem of testing, specifically, you know, sampling taken from thoroughbreds after racing, and whether or not the protocols that are in place and the science behind those protocols are robust enough to keep up with what scientists and lab techs that work in the industry say is basically cheaters that are outstripping and moving more quickly than the science of catching them. As noted, this is part of an ongoing series, which will look at the State Gaming Commission, will look at whether investigations are robust enough, whether the resources are sufficient there to meet the challenge of catching cheaters, as well as other issues that the industry is dealing with. You know, many people will say, geez, the Times Union covers Saratoga every summer. Why are you criticizing, as it were, a business, an industry that is so important to one of our regional economies in Saratoga Springs? And my response to that, of course, is because we do devote so much coverage to the Saratoga meet in July, August, and September, it is especially incumbent upon the Times Union to take a hard look at these issues. This is an industry that matters very much to the Capital Region. And for that reason, it's incumbent upon the journalists who cover the region to look at it skeptically, critically, fairly. And I think this series is doing that extremely well. The series is ongoing and will continue for the next couple of weeks. I encourage people to check into timesunion.com to read the ones that are already there if they haven't gotten to them yet, and keep an eye out for new installments.
All right. Once again, head over to timesunion.com for that. One last topic I want to touch on, and I want to make sure I'm hearing this right, but those iconic sapphire sparkling bottles of Saratoga water don't actually necessarily come from Saratoga. What's going on there?
Yes. Speaking of an important and iconic spa city business, Saratoga Springs Water, you know, has been around for more than a century. New government-mandated labels, as pointed out by our outstanding business reporter, Rick Carlin, note that the water actually comes from White Cedar Springs in Maine, which is about 300 miles from Saratoga. Of course, this is part of kind of the ongoing question of whether something is essentially just a brand or is in fact a product of a specific geographic location. A call to the company was not returned. You know, and we've seen this before. You know, is Poland Springs water actually from someplace called Poland Springs? You know, it's a hilarious story, and another one that I would direct people to timesunion.com to check out.
Indeed. I currently have some flowers inside one of those blue bottles that I had saved. So I get to look at it every day. All right, Casey, thank you so much for joining us, and we will check back in with you next week.
Thanks, Jess.
As always, you can read more about all of the stories and the issues that we discuss on this podcast at timesunion.com. The Winter Olympics are underway in Beijing this week. The sport of figure skating is arguably one of the more popular sports at the Games, and it happens to be a particular area of expertise for me. I've been a competitive figure skater since I was 8. I still compete today as an adult. I've also been a coach and, for a very brief period of time, a judge. It's no secret that I've been glued to the live streams of the Olympic figure skating events, and I've been live tweeting my hot takes with every turn of the blade. But news broke midweek that the 15-year-old Russian phenom and gold medal favorite Kamila Valieva had reportedly failed a drug test for a banned substance. My newsroom colleague Lee Hornbeck immediately reached out to me for my take on this developing situation, and I was more than happy to oblige. Here is some of our conversation recorded just a few hours after American skater Nathan Chen won the gold medal in the men's event on Thursday.
What is it like to see these competitors pulling off these jumps and these elements? Explain what it takes to perform that.
Well, first of all, when I was watching the men's long program, I had to pick myself up off the floor several times because I was just so impressed by some of the skating that I saw. The quadruple jump right now is the most technically difficult element that anybody performs, man or woman, in single skating. You know, to kind of give you an idea of how that works, the skater will take off at, in some cases, breakneck speed backwards, whether using their toe or their edge, unless it's an axel, but I don't want to get too technical. They'll take off forward for that. But they'll take off backward, vault into the air. I think I saw some skaters were, you know, almost like a meter in the air. They jump really, really high, and they rotate four times, and then they come back down to earth and land on one foot on the ice. And to do that, it takes, in my opinion, something superhuman.
That's astounding. We've seen both men and women do that. There are some questions now about just how superhuman Kamila Valieva may have been.
Yes. Kamila Valieva is the superstar Russian ladies competitor. She became the first woman in history to land a quadruple jump on Olympic ice. And everybody kind of expected it because she, going into this competition, she was heavily favored to win. However, things blew up a little bit late this week when there were reports that she had taken performance-enhancing drugs, which, in my opinion, kind of dims the luster of her presence at the Olympics. And it's hard to watch as an outsider, but also someone who is inside the figure skating world, because it would never have occurred to me that taking performance-enhancing drugs would really do anything to make performances that much better, because there's no magic pill that you can take to land your jumps. I mean, if you have a wonky takeoff, there's very little that you can do to salvage it. But in this case, the drug in question is a heart medication that was banned. It's a banned substance because it does have the ability to improve blood flow to the heart and thus improve your endurance so that you're just kind of stronger out there overall. But it can't guarantee that you're going to land your jumps or that the judges are going to think that you're awesome. So,
wow. Could she be disqualified from skating in the ladies' long program? There is some precedent because the Russians had already been in trouble for doping, which is why the athletes are here under the ROC banner. Mm-hmm. What, based on what has happened in the past, could happen if she's found to be guilty of this, I guess?
Sure. It's really hard to tell from this far away from the action as both a skater and a journalist. But my instinct is that she will be allowed to skate. I could be proven wrong in the next 5 minutes, of course, but that would be my instinct. She is a minor. She's 15 years old. She's considered a minor by the IOC, and as such, may not be held liable for taking performance-enhancing drugs. You could argue that, you know, maybe her team gave it to her without her knowledge or pressured her to take it. You know, there's all kinds of situations where a minor should not be held liable for something like this. And, you know, as such, I could see, you know, her being allowed to skate in this competition. She was going to practices, so I'm not sure what that says yet. But if she does skate and she skates well, or even if she doesn't skate well, there will always be that cloud over her head. And, you know, how much will a win or even a performance be worth and at what cost? So I think the damage has already been done for this particular skater and for that event.
You said to me that this has made you more emotional than you would have expected, even though you're not shocked or surprised. It still made you sad. It feels to me like your heart is with, because you've been that 15-year-old skater and you're really thinking of the athlete. Talk to us about that.
Knowing what it's like to be an athlete in a high-pressure situation, like, it breaks my heart for her and for her competitors. And anytime there's a suggestion of cheating in the figure skating world, it just makes my heart sink lower. I mean, I'm used to a certain level of competition fixing. You know, at the small rinky-dink level, competition fixing still happens. I mean, my coach spoke to a judge after an event that I competed in once, and the judge basically admitted that they had to fix the scores a certain way. I'm like, well, you know, it's dejecting, but it's life in the figure skating world, you know, and it's very hard to change that culture that is at times very toxic. So when you hear about it on a higher level like this, where someone's actually taking performance-enhancing drugs to cheat, it doesn't make the sport look good. It cheats all the athletes out of an experience that would otherwise be, you know, one of the highlights of their lives.
The ladies' portion of the figure skating competition comes up next week. After the break, we will talk to one of the stars of Fly, a drama about the Tuskegee Airmen, on stage this month at Capitol Repertory Theater.
Hi, I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. Join us for an ongoing discussion on major developments in the saga of Keith Raniere, co-founder of Nexium, the shadowy upstate New York organization at the center of the explosive federal investigation that resulted in Raniere's conviction on charges of extortion, sex trafficking, and more. We talk to former members of Nexium, discuss the latest news, and preview the likely next twists in this bizarre and disturbing story. You can find Nexium on Trial at timesunion.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Eagle, a Times Union podcast. I'm Jessica Marshall. In 1941, in the thick of World War II, the United States Army Air Corps formed the first ever black military pilot group called the Tuskegee Airmen. This month at The Rep in downtown Albany, theatergoers can take in a drama based on the experience of those pilots. Fly follows the story of four Tuskegee Airmen as they face both war on a foreign stage and overt and systemic racism within the country that they're fighting for. Throughout the 90-minute show, the pilots' inner struggles and triumphs are portrayed through the movements and sounds of an omniscient narrator named the Tap Griot. Omar Edwards pioneered the role in the original 2007 production of Fly. He's played it in more than a dozen productions, and he's reprising it here in Albany this month. Senior writer Steve Barnes had a chance to talk to Edwards this week about the show and his craft, as well as the lessons he learned from tap greats like Gregory Hines and his own cousin, Savion Glover. Here's some of their conversation.
Tap dancing for me is a voice. When you amplify the voice, you can get into nuances. And when you get into nuances, you can get into sophistication. And that's where 35 years of my love affair with tap dancing has ended me up, into sophistication.
When the earth falls away from your feet, your soul rises and joins the heaven that connects us all.
And in Fly, your character functions as the conscience of the show, but he's also the inner emotions of the characters. He's able to express what they have to stifle. So tell me how you work with the actors to create what goes on in the scene, because you are what they can't say. They're standing there with these racist white superiors who do want any possible reason to boot them from the program, and they have to stifle that. And you're the one that expresses it.
During the piece, that happens in different ways. Sometimes it happens in the dance. Most of the time, it happens in the dance. And sometimes it happens through mime.
All right, well, there's this great moment where there's 300 people all looking at you, and the only thing that's happening, tap, tap, tap. Your feet are a flurry so many times in the show, and there's a lot, there's a big physicality, and here it was just, and it's magical.
Yes.
How does that feel when you've got 300 or 500 or 800 people just watching that 1 foot tap?
I've been doing this for 35 years and I was not a prodigy. You know, I simply was fortunate that Savion Glover was my cousin. And it didn't mean that I immediately had Savion Glover's skills, because I still don't. But what it does mean is I had access to his environment. I could call his mother and she could say, come Omar, be here. And then I'd show up and Gregory Hines is right here. And, you know, Jimmy Slide is right here. And you know, of course, everybody's, oh, Savion, but I'm running around backstage following Gregory Hines and Jimmy Slide and following Savion too. So I came in as a rookie, as a runt. I'm an inner city kid. I'm from Far Rockaway, Queens, New York. My mom died when I was 10. My dad was in prison when I was 2, so I didn't see him again until I was like 16. So it was almost impossible to get that kind of education anywhere in my setup. One day I was going to school one morning and my grandmother who raised me, God bless her soul, Bernadine Edwards, she showed me this newspaper, said, Omar, this is your cousin, tap dance kid. And I was like, okay, cool, whatever. And then it was a family reunion. And then he showed up and everybody was like, ooh. And then we argued and went out and competition began. He's 2 years older than me. So it's like a big brother thing. And then that's how it happened. Right then and there, I started showing up. There was no dance school where you learn how to do a routine. And then in June, you do a recital based on your information that you took in for a year. No, that's called the choreographer's dream. I'm a choreographer's nightmare because I was around the masters, the best who could do it, but nobody was teaching me. They were all just like doing it. And I was just absorbing it and taking what I like and not caring about the lines. It was a long time before I did eventually go to dance school. I did eventually study with Henry Luttang. I did eventually be in my first Broadway show tour, which was Black and Blue, which I had to deal with Henry Luttang as a choreographer. So all these years of me being, I'm the guy who slipped in the side door. That's what one jazz musician said, it, an old friend of mine, George. He said, Omar, I get it. You slipped in the side door. And he's right. I'm the one that wasn't really supposed to be a dancer. I wasn't really supposed to do, I chose it. You know, I had, my grandmother was raising me. I could have made any choice I wanted. I could have went this way or that way. And because of Savion was out there enough for me to see an example, I said, oh, I'm going to do that. I've become a people's dancer. I'm not a dancer's dancer. because dancers are looking to be inspired by stuff that they can't do. All of the stuff that I can do that dancers can't do is internal and spirit. Because in order to pull off learning and becoming something in a culture when you wasn't supposed to learn or become anything, you have to have an abominable spirit. You can't take, "Ooh, you're not good," you know, to heart. You know, it just rubbed right off me until I became good. Tap dancing became a celebration for me. That's what it is. It's not a job. It's a study. I don't think I was born to tap dance. So I think it'll take my entire 70 years before I can turn around and go, "I'm a tap dancer." I knew that tap dancing really is how to make your feet captivating. That is what tap dancing is. It's captivation of a person who manipulates their feet. I'm trying to get to your heart, to tell you story after story after story, just like country music, just like blues. There's, you know, there's content in my dancing that involves your heart without a word sometimes, most of the time. It's about my reason for dancing. It's how I approach the sound, and it's how I approach pulling an audience to me and giving them something.
Fly is playing at Capitol Repertory Theater now through February 20th. Okay, let's move from stage now to the small screen. And just like that, the much-anticipated sequel series to the Sex and the City franchise concluded its 10-episode season this month. The series stars original players Sarah Jessica Parker, Kristen Davis, and Cynthia Nixon as Carrie, Charlotte, and Miranda. And they navigate privileged life in New York, this time in their mid-50s. Reviews of the series have been, let's say, polarizing. That's fair. But we're talking about it here on The Eagle now because in the final episode, there's a little bit of a Capital Region connection. And it all has to do with a traditional Jewish head covering worn by Charlotte's husband, Harry Goldenblatt, in several of the scenes. I talked to business reporter Shayla Cologne to find out more about this special kippah.
So where does this appear in the show and when does it come into play?
So, of course, we don't actually see this rainbow kippah worn until the season finale of End Just Like That. And it's worn by Harry Goldenblatt as he celebrates his child's They Mitzvah. His child, essentially, Rock, comes out as non-binary. And Harry really just wraps his arms around this and wants to show support for Rock. So the rainbow kippah is a symbol of that.
So describe the kippah. What does it look like and what is it made of?
It's very small. Because it's only meant to cover the very top of your head. And this specific kippah is rainbowed color, which aligns with the LGBTQ colors and their symbol for solidarity. And it's made out of a crocheted material. So it's very soft and just a sort of rich texture. It comes from a Mayan village in the Guatemalan highlands called San Paulo.
So how did it end up at a shop in Albany?
There's a nonprofit organization called Mayan Hands based here in Albany, and they're very big on fair trade. So they work with women in the Guatemalan Highlands, specifically this village in San Paulo, to bring their products and their weaving and artwork to the global markets. Part of that entails having them make the kippahs in their homelands, and then they are brought here to a warehouse in Albany on Whitehall Road, and that's where they're distributed from.
That's so cool. So you talked to the owner of the shop. What did she say?
Brenda's amazing. She's just one of those people you just want to hug when you hear them speak. She told me about her previous history and how this organization was founded. She is an archaeologist and was doing a lot of work in Guatemala and Mexico when she was younger, and it really struck her to see these women suffer discrimination and just financial distress because they didn't have a way to provide for their families, despite their artistic abilities to create these weavings like kippahs and other clothing. So she decided to solve that problem, and she did by creating Mayan Hands. So the women make about 450 kippah a month, and they sell about 3,000 a year. Kippa sold by Mayan hands is about $4. In Mexico and Guatemala, you can get the same kippa for about $1. Brenda's friend said that she would rather pay $1. Brenda explained to her that when you pay $1 for a kippa rather than $4 for Mayan hands, it's an exploitive practice. And these women aren't getting the income that they deserve to benefit themselves personally. She made it her mission to make sure that they are fairly reimbursed or fairly compensated for their work. And that's how Mayan hands sort of grew.
Tell me, she told you kind of the details about how the Sex and the City and Just Like That producers kind of were tipped off about it. Can you talk about what she told you there?
Sure. So Brenda was just having a regular day going about her business when she got a random call, and it was an HBO Max producer. They were able to find her yarmulkes online, and they read about her mission to make sure these women in Guatemala were fairly compensated for their work. And they figured, well, we need a bunch for this scene on a show, so can you provide them for us? And she said, yes, of course. But they didn't tell her what show. So, So when they called back to ask for 60 more, they again were very vague and did not tell her what show. So she happened to be watching the reboot when in the season finale, she spotted her yarmulke on the head of Harry Goldenblatt and was just thriving with excitement and happiness when she realized that this is where her handiwork had gone.
Oh my goodness, that is so exciting. She had a much better time than Peloton must have if when they discovered what happened in that. But you've told me before that you have not watched any of the Sex and the City series or And Just Like That or any of the movies. So what made you want to write this story?
I think what made me want to write this story is the culture behind it. There's the just beautiful Jewish culture and the parallel that's made in the Sex and the City reboot to acceptance and supporting one another, especially for those in the LGBTQ community. But I don't think they realized how closely tethered this was to the Mayan Hands mission to support women globally and give them what they deserve for the work that they put in. Seeing this kippa being worn on Harry Goldenblatt's head, which is someone who is pretty wealthy in this show, it just means a lot to these women. And it's just nice seeing their work come to fruition.
All right, that's it for this week. I'm Jessica Marshall. We'll be back next week with another look inside the newsroom here at the Times Union. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, or head over to timesunion.com for the latest news and features. The Eagle is a production of the Times Union. It's produced and edited by me, Jessica Marshall, with help from the Times Union digital team and the newsroom. Special thanks this week to Casey Seiler, Lee Hornbeck, Steve Barnes, and Shayla Colon for their contribution to this episode.